2 Samuel chapter 8, David. It says in chapter 8, verse 1, "And after this, it came to pass." After what? Well, if you were here last week, you remember 2 Samuel chapter 7, where David was at rest and had decided, it's just not right. I'm in a palace. I should build a house for God. The ark is in town now, but it's still in a tent. And how can it be that I have a palace of cedar and God lives in the tent? And Nathan the prophet was there and said, "Sure, that sounds great. Do all that's in your heart." And then the Lord spoke to Nathan that night and said, "Next time, why don't you ask me first? No, I don't want him to build me a house." And then he gave the promises to David. "I know that you want to build me a house, but you're not going to build me a house. I'm going to build you a house." And he gave him a prophecy about the Messiah coming from his lineage and setting up a kingdom that'll never end. And in the midst of that, after David got the promise, it said in 2 Samuel 7, verse 18, "Then went King David in and sat before the Lord, and he said, 'Who am I, O Lord God? And what is my house that thou hast brought me hitherto?'" Who am I that you would even show me this kindness, that you'd want to use me? I'm nothing. And then we have the end of chapter 7, which is David's prayer, praise song, however you want to look at it, where he just praises God and prays really in agreement with God's plan. Rather than get up in a bunch because he can't build the temple like he wanted to, he instead immediately gets on board with God's plan to have his son do it. And chapter 8, he starts laying the groundwork. And it says, "And after this, it came to pass that David smote the Philistines and subdued them. And David took Methegamma out of the hand of the Philistines." Methegamma. If you look at 1 Chronicles chapter 18, verse 1, and you don't have to go there. It's the same parallel account. And it tells us that that's the city of Gath. The Methegamma, the Metha means bridle. Because of where that was situated in its strategic location, it was really a key spot, and it kept Israel in check. By holding that area, they were able to subdue really the whole land. And it's funny because David now is being king, is doing what Saul didn't do and what Israel never did after Jonathan, which is actually take some territory according to what God had originally promised. Because even though they were in the promised land and had been there for hundreds of years now, they had never really taken the promises, made up the ground, done the things that God had for them. And so David decides, well, I'm not going to build them a house because I'm a man of blood. I might as well go do what it is I'm good at and let me build up. And we're going to see he's going to expand the territory, and he's also going to lay up provision for his son to do the thing that God promised. So the first thing he does is he heads to Gath and he whips up on the Philistines. Then in verse 2 it says, "He smote Moab and measured them with a line, casting them down to the ground. Even with two lines measured he to put to death, and with one full line to keep alive. And so the Moabites became David's servants and brought him gifts." And Psalm 60 kind of talks about this. He went after Moab. Now that's kind of, you might hear that and say, well, why did he go after Moab? In fact, when you think about it, his great-grandmother is Ruth, who was a Moabitess. You know, Ruth and Boaz begat Obed, begat Jesse, begat David. And then, if you remember right, in a few chapters ago in 1 Samuel 22, when he was running from Saul, he brought his family down to Moab, and he left them in the charge of the king of Moab. Some extra-biblical sources, some historians say perhaps, or they say for sure, although I don't know enough that I can say for sure because it's not in the scripture, that the king of Moab mistreated his family. Some of the accounts I read said that he killed his parents, and that's part of why this happened. I don't know. Whatever it is, it seems pretty harsh on one hand, that he measured them with a line, casting them down to the ground. Again, and even within that, I found some people say, well, what he did was he made two measurements and, you know, kind of like only kids this tall can ride this ride, and anybody who's too tall he killed. I don't think so. It sounds like he pretty much just laid them all down on the ground and said, die, die, live, die, die, you know, and he killed two out of every three. Interesting to note, the third that were left brought gifts to David when he was done. And it literally means to bring tribute. And what he's doing with these nations as he goes in and he's defeating them is he's bringing them into subjection so that they pay tribute, they pay taxes. He doesn't wipe them out completely, but he completely takes out the threat. It says in verse 3, "And David smote also Hadadezer, the son of Rehob, the king of Zobah, as he went to recover his border at the river Euphrates." See, he is tremendously, one of the commentators I listened to said that it went from about 6,000 square miles to 60,000 square miles, 10 times the size Israel ended up being. In Genesis chapter 15, verse 18, Lord with Abraham, in the same day the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, unto thy seed have I given this land, from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates, all the way down from Egypt, all the way up to the north of Euphrates. Well, David apparently reads Genesis and says, you know, I bet that was literal. I think I'm going to apply it. And he heads up north towards Euphrates. And on his way there, he runs into Hadadezer, who's the king of Zobah. It says, and David took from him 1,000 chariots and 700 horsemen and 20,000 footmen. And David huffed or haked or hawked or he hamstrung. It's an old English word. It's tough to find a good pronunciation. Places I looked, he hamstrung all the horses, what he did, cut the Achilles tendon, but reserved of them for 100 chariots. When he comes against this army that's got a huge chariot force, and the chariot was the armored vehicle, or at least the attack vehicle of the day, and they're on foot, but they were told not to, you know, trust in chariots. You remember in Deuteronomy 17, whenever a king, God said, when you have a king, he's not supposed to multiply chariots to himself, you know, trust in his military strength. He's not supposed to multiply wives to himself, which David doesn't do so good at. And he's not supposed to multiply gold to himself. And when David defeats these guys, he disables their army is what he does. He's not being mean to the animals, but they don't have a real need for horses. They were told, well, one, they weren't going to trust in horses. The Lord was going to fight for them, and they weren't. Even in their farming, when they get into the land, they weren't really to be using horses because the Lord said, I'm going to bring, you know, you were in Egypt and you were in a land that was watered by the foot. And they would literally use pedal devices and things to bring the water from the Nile in to fertilize the land. And it required their work. And he says, I'm going to bring you into a place where I'm going to water the land. And so he's got no uses for these horses. He doesn't want to leave them there to be a thorn in his side. So he disables them. And it kind of gives you a little insight when he writes in Psalm 20, verse 7, writing a song, David says, some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we will remember the name of the Lord our God. He says in Psalm 33, there is no king saved by the multitude of a host. A mighty man is not delivered by much strength. A horse is a vain thing for safety, and neither shall he deliver any by his great strength. And David's like, you know, God allowed me to beat 1,000 horses. Do I really need 1,000 horses if I can already beat them? So he disables them. And then verse 5, and when the Syrians of Damascus came to succor Hadadezer, the king of Zobah, David slew of the Syrians 22,000 men. So he is just wiping people out left and right. And then look what he does. It says, then David put garrisons in Syria of Damascus. And the Syrians became servants to David and brought gifts. And the Lord preserved David whithersoever he went. You know, and as we go through these chapters tonight, there is the literal historical interpretation, which, you know, this really happened, and these are the things that David did. But then there's also some spiritual implications to all of this stuff. You know, it tells us in Corinthians, Paul says that those things that happened to the Israelites as they wandered on their journey happened to them for an example for us, that we can look at these things and see that, you know, we can take lessons certainly from how they acted or didn't act, but we also, there's some spiritual stuff to this. And I look at Israel being in this land and yet never taking what God had given them, you know. And really, all it really took was somebody to get on the throne in there that trusted God and actually did what he said and was the type of king that was after his heart. And then all of a sudden, the Lord preserves him wherever he goes. He has victory after victory after victory. We're going to see he just wiped out here 22,000, plus he took out the 1,000 horsemen and 20,000 of Syrian before that, and the Philistines and the Ammonites and all of them. And he's got 18,000 guys. So he's beaten huge numbers with a smaller amount. And I think about how many times do we not take what God has given for provision. How many Christians do you know that, you know, they have the same promises we all have in the Bible? Or how many times, and I say they, how many times do we look at the promises that are in the Bible and think, I can't do that. I mean, yeah, it says that, you know, I'll have peace that passes understanding, and that, you know, he came to give me joy abundantly and all that, but that's, I just can't do that. Or I can't really step out in faith and trust him to provide for me, or I can't. But yet we look at David, and not only does David go in and wipe out all of the enemies that they had never been able to conquer. He tears down stronghold after stronghold. He conquers false king after false king. But then in verse 6, he puts up garrisons. He conquers these enemies, and then he puts up a fixed defense in place so that they won't rise up and bite him again. When he comes against the enemies of Syria that have all these horsemen, he doesn't leave the horsemen there. He doesn't leave the horses in town, but yet he completely disables them so they can't trouble him again. Now he's putting up garrisons. And I look at that because I think there's wisdom in that. You know, David is not, yes, the Lord is preserving him everywhere he goes, but he's not so naive to think that that means he doesn't have to be careful, he doesn't have to pay attention, he doesn't have to set things up so that he doesn't get attacked in those areas again. You know, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 12 says, "Wherefore let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall." Romans 13, verse 14 says, "Put you on the Lord Jesus Christ and make not provision for the flesh to fulfill the lusts thereof." And there's a lot of things that we can do as believers to put up blocks, to put up, you know, I know I was looking at some stuff I found the other day, some internet software. I was sharing it with Bob, some cool different devices that you can get to monitor and protect yourself. You know, there's certainly software that you can get that will monitor everywhere you go on the internet. You know, there's some of them that have an accountability feature set in so that it will automatically email somebody that you set up, you know, any place if you happen to go someplace you shouldn't go. As parents, there's a little thing you can get put on your computer that's pretty much undetectable that will monitor for when your kids are using the internet, where they're going. It'll monitor their instant messaging chats. It'll monitor the website. It'll monitor, you know, email, who comes in and out from all of that stuff, because that's a wise thing to do. You know, I mean, my main computer at the house sits in my living room, and it sits there for a reason, so that I don't have my kids running off into another room, because I was a kid who spent some time on a computer in the other room growing up, and I'd like to say that everything that I did on that, praise God, there really wasn't much for an internet back then. I had to dial out to places, but they were still there. I could find them. I made sure I knew how. And it behooves us to set up defenses. You know, if you are a person who has fought and lost to alcohol in the past, why would you keep the Clydesdales in your fridge? It makes no sense to keep the horses here when you know they've run you down in the past. Dump it out, get it out of your house. If you know, I have friends that I know who are godly guys who don't have an internet connection in their house because they can't, because they know their weaknesses, or they, you know, their TV gone, no TV, because I know that would be a weakness for them. And I think there's wisdom in that, to see David defeat these areas because he trusts the Lord, and then installing safeguards so that he doesn't get bit by him again. And it says the Lord preserved David whithersoever he went. And David took the shields of gold that were on the servants of Hadadezer and brought them to Jerusalem. And from Betah and from Berothai, cities of Hadadezer, King David took exceeding much brass. David, not only does he defeat them, he took some trophies. He brings back, they apparently had some very expensive, I don't know if it was on the elite guard of that country or whatever, but when he beat them, he took a trophy back. And I think at times, you know, it's appropriate for us to take trophies as well. When we have a victory, and sometimes there's a tendency for Christians to get together and a conversation can turn into a, you know, let's talk about who was the worst sinner. Let's glory in our old lives about how horrible we were. Oh, yeah, well, you would think you were bad. Then I used to, And I'm not saying that. But I think God makes trophies. You know, I was looking through the book Harvest. I don't know if you've ever read the Calvary Chapel book Harvest. Chuck Smith talks about some of the guys who originally got saved after he started Calvary Chapel and went out and started churches in other areas. And you look at some of these guys, a majority of them were just extreme druggies, you know, taking everything they could pump into their bodies, minds fried, that have been redeemed. You had guys like Bill Galton, who started Calvary Chapel in Finger Lakes, kind of the first venture into the East Coast, who not only was a heavy drug user, was flat out possessed for a while. You had Bob Coy, who used to be in the entertainment industry, first in the music industry, and then eventually was the head of a bunch of nude showgirls at a casino. That was, you know, and he's like, I was listening to his testimony one day, and he's talking about, yeah, somewhere out there was on, you know, a picture of me with a bunch of strippers on the front of a magazine. Bob Coy, and now he's pastor of 30,000 people at a church in Fort Lauderdale. Or you look at, you know, Raul Ruiz, when he got saved, he was waiting at his house with a rifle to shoot his wife when she came home, and he happened to turn on the TV and heard the gospel and got saved. In fact, when he went out, he left after he gets saved there with his rifle and runs out, and his wife comes home, and then he comes back and is trying to come in so he can tell her, and she won't let him in the door because she thinks that he's still going to kill her. You know, you see guys like that that are trophies, and I think, you know, you look around here at the people in this church that the Lord has taken the refuse of the world and made us trophies. And it's important to remember the victories that we have. Certainly we're told that we're supposed to comfort people with the comfort that we've been comforted with. Well, I think we can also encourage people with the stories of our victories and the ways that he has had the victory in our lives. And so he takes back the golden shields, he takes back the brass, and you might start to think, well, maybe he's doing what he was told not to do in Deuteronomy 17 about, you know, multiplying gold to himself. Wasn't he said not to do that? But look what he does. Well, verse 9, it says, when Toi, king of Hamath, heard that David had smitten all the host of Hadadezer, then Toi sent Joram, his son, unto King David to salute him and to bless him because he had fought against Hadadezer and smitten him, for Hadadezer had wars with Toi. And Joram brought with him vessels of silver and vessels of gold and vessels of brass, which also King David did dedicate unto the Lord with the silver and the gold that he had dedicated of all nations which he subdued. You know, this king of Toi shows up because they had fought with some of the kings that David had beaten, and it's kind of one of those the enemy of my enemy is my friend things, where he wasn't Israel, but he was friendly with Israel because David was beating the same people that were beating up on him. And he brings all this stuff in, and David doesn't keep any of it, but he lays it all up because he knows his son has to build a temple, and he can't build a temple. Much as he wants, he can't. So he said, you know, I can't build a temple, but I can expand the territory, and I can provide the resources. And you know, when we get to Solomon's kingdom in 1 Kings chapter 10 and in a couple places in Chronicles, it tells us that the nation is so wealthy that silver is like stones. Gold, in Chronicles it says gold and silver were almost like rocks. It was everywhere. And when you think about Solomon's temple being completely overlaid inside with pure gold, unbelievable. And yet all this stuff that David got, it wasn't for himself. It was laying up treasure for God's house. In verse 12 it says, of Syria and of Moab, and of the children of Ammon, and of the Philistines, and of Amalek, and of the spoil of Hadadezer, son of Rehob, king of Zobah. And David gat him a name when he returned from smiting of the Syrians in the Valley of Salt, being 18,000 men. 18,000 men defeating, what, 50, 75, 100,000? I mean, it doesn't get, we get 22 in one place, 20 in another. You know, there's a serious amount of people that he beat with those 18,000 men. And he gets a name. And, you know, I look at that and I think, well, what kind of name do we have individually and as a church? Yeah, but individually, what kind of name as a Christian do you have? Because we're in a war. In the same way David is having battle after battle after battle, we have battle. You know, we're told the whole New Testament, it seems like, is full of military examples. Paul, obviously, some of it because he was chained to a Roman soldier, but he uses analogy of, after analogy of military stuff. Peter says in 1 Peter 2:11, dearly beloved, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul. And because we're in a different kind of war, we're not in a physical war. You know, Paul tells us we don't war against flesh and blood, but against powers and principalities. The kind of thing that should make a name for us as a believer is that we fight the type of war, the spiritual war, the internal war, the war against the flesh that Peter talks about. It's victory in that war that gives us a name. Paul tells us in Ephesians 6, put on the whole armor of God. And he tells about all those things that characterize us in that battle, how it's truth, righteousness, salvation, faith, the preparation of the gospel, the word, the sword of the Spirit. Those are the things that should make a name for us as believers. Paul gives one of those promises that isn't, it's not that exciting, you know. I mean, it's true. He's talking to, I guess it's more of a command than a promise when he's talking to Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 2. Verse 3 says, thou therefore endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. A good soldier, if we want to make a name as a soldier of Christ, needs to endure hardness. And then he says, no man that wars entangles himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who has chosen him to be a soldier. You know, a good soldier doesn't get entangled, he endures. And that's the kind of war we're in. That's how we make a name for ourselves. A name in the Lord's army is those who consciously say, I'm in a war, I'm not going to get entangled, and then hump over and take it sometimes. Certainly take up all of the armor he gives us. It says, and he put, in verse 14, he put garrisons in Edom. Throughout all Edom put he garrisons. And all they of Edom became David's servants, and the Lord preserved David whithersoever he went. And David reigned over all of Israel. He is the greatest king. You know, the kingdom never came together underneath Saul. It was underneath David. When he finally came in, a man after God's own heart, he reigned over all of Israel, and certainly for us, our desire is to reign over all of our life. And unfortunately, it seems like our fight more time is with our life than it is with the enemies outside of us. But David reigns over all of Israel, and as a good king, David executed judgment and justice unto all his people. Kind of in the Romans 13 sort of way about how government, that's what government is supposed to do, execute judgment and justice. And we have come a long way from that. And then we get a little layout of how his kingdom worked. It said, it's pretty simple, really. Joab, the son of Zeruiah, was over the host. The captain of the army, Joab, one guy. You want to know about the army? Go see Joab. And Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was recorder. He was the record keeper, apparently. And Zadok, the son of Ahitub, and Ahimelech, the son of Abiathar, were the priests. You guys overseeing the priestly duties, and Sariah the scribe, and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada was over both of the Cherethites, both the Cherethites and the Pelethites, and David's sons were chief rulers. Benaiah, he's one of my favorite guys. You know, any of you guys who know me, I have a cat named Benaiah, named after this guy, because it's a cool, it's a manly name. Benaiah, we read about him. We're going to see him in chapter 23. There's certain names for people that really would make good names, except for they're completely unpronounceable, or they would just sound really weird in this country, in this culture, so we don't use them. But I have cats named Benaiah and Shamgar after two heroes. Shamgar's only got one verse, but it says that he killed 600 guys with an ox goad. That should be a man's name, Shamgar. That should be way up above, you know, I don't know, some of the names that are out there today. Benaiah tells us in 2 Samuel 23, verse 20, Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, the son of a valiant man of Kabzeel, who had done many acts. He slew two lion-like men of Moab. What was that all about? What were lion-like men? Were they hairy? Did they have big beards? Were they tough? I don't know. He went down also and slew a lion in the midst of a pit in the time of snow. I've been to the zoo, the Philadelphia Zoo. I go there every couple of years when I go down with my family. I saw the lion on the other side of the moat. I ain't going in there for nothing. I don't care what kind of gun I have. Doesn't matter. I'm not going to fight a lion. This guy, not only did he kill two lion-like men, he kills a lion in a pit in the middle of winter. And he slew an Egyptian, a goodly man. And the Egyptian had a spear in his hand, but he went down to him with a staff and plucked the spear out of the Egyptian's hand and slew him with his own spear. He's a tough guy. He's a guy who is not afraid of anything. And David puts him over, it says, the Cherethites and the Pelethites. They were the special forces. They were actually hired soldiers. They were not Israelites. I believe at least one group was from Greece area, perhaps from the Philistines. And they were, because that would keep him from, you know, any of the tribal stuff, if there was anybody in another tribe who wanted to assassinate David, you know, from a tribal struggle. So he's got some outside special forces, but Benaiah is the guy he's the head of security. He's the chief of the Secret Service. And then his sons are in there as well. So it's simple, it's well-ordered, because, you know, God does require a well-ordered kingdom. Now we come to chapter 9. Let me read chapter 9, but I want to start with a foundation of chapter 9 by reading 1 Samuel chapter 20, verse 14. This was back when Jonathan and Saul were still alive. Jonathan, Saul's son, best friends with David. And they they make an agreement. It says in 1 Samuel chapter 20, verse 14, this is Jonathan talking to David, "And thou shalt not only, while yet I live, show me the kindness of the Lord," notice that, "the kindness of the Lord, that I die not, but also thou shalt not cut off thy kindness from my house forever. No, not when the Lord has cut off the enemies of David, every one from the face of the earth." So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "Let the Lord even require it at the hand of David's enemies." And Jonathan caused David to swear again because he loved him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. So you've got Jonathan and David making an agreement, because Jonathan is in a weird place of loving David and recognizing him as God's anointed, God's chosen guy, but also being the son of somebody who thinks that David's trying to steal the throne from him and hence is trying to kill him. So Jonathan has already said, "I know you're the right king, and I'm not going to stand in your way." But he says, "I want you to make me a promise that not only will you show kindness to me, but that you will show the kindness of the Lord to my family after I'm gone." Well, then Jonathan and Saul are now dead. And we come to chapter 9, and we see the fulfillment of that. Let me read it. It's only 13 verses, and then we'll come back and go through it. "And David said, Is there yet any that is left of the house of Saul, that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake? And there was of the house of Saul a servant, whose name was Ziba. And when they had called him unto David, the king said unto him, Art thou Ziba? And he said, Thy servant is he. And the king said, Is there not yet any of the house of Saul, that I may show kindness of God unto him? And Ziba said unto the king, Jonathan hath yet a son, which is lame on his feet. And the king said unto him, Where is he? And Ziba said unto the king, Behold, he's in the house of Maker, the son of Ammiel, in Lodabar. Then King David sent and fetched him out of the house of Machir, the son of Ammiel, from Lodabar. Now when Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, was come unto David, he fell on his face and did reverence. And David said, Mephibosheth. And he answered, Behold, thy servant. David said unto him, Fear not, for I will surely show thee kindness for Jonathan thy father's sake, and will restore thee all the land of Saul thy father, and thou shalt eat bread at my table continually. And he bowed himself and said, What is thy servant that thou should look upon, such a dead dog as I am? Then the king called to Ziba, Saul's servant, and said unto him, I have given unto thy master's son all that pertained to Saul and all his house. Thou therefore and thy sons and thy servants shall till the land for him, and thou shalt bring in the fruits, that thy master's son may have food to eat. But Mephibosheth, thy master's son, shall eat bread alway at my table. Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Then said Ziba unto the king, According to all that my lord the king has commanded his servant, so shall thy servant do. As for Mephibosheth, said the king, he shall eat at my table as one of the king's sons. And Mephibosheth had a young son whose name was Micah. And all that dwelt in the house of Ziba were servants unto Mephibosheth. So Mephibosheth dwelt in Jerusalem, for he did eat continually at the king's table, and was lame on both his feet. We see this picture. David is here, okay? He's at rest. He has subdued all his enemies. He's had that conversation in his heart where he said, God, what can I do for you? You know, I want to build a house for you. What can I do for you? And God said, you're not going to build me a house. Your son's going to build me a house. And so David said, well, then I can make that ready. And he has done what he needed to do. He has conquered the territory. He has helped prepare the resources so it'll be there. So now that he's got that in tune, David looks outward and he said, who can I help for Jonathan's sake? Because you got to figure, David's on the throne now. You know, David's a king. David's a soldier king, you know, and the wars are pretty much done at this point. He's conquered pretty much most of the battles he needs to do, so he's there, and he's enjoying it. And you know, he's still got that little bit of stepping back and looking at his life and remembering all the promises that God made and then how impossible they seemed. And now he is sitting there in the middle of it. And, you know, I'm sure he's thinking back about his time with Jonathan, about how Jonathan had said to him, David, I know you're going to be on the throne, and I'll be right there by your side, and it'll just be great. I know you're the one that God has chosen. And now he's sitting there, and Jonathan's dead. Jonathan died when Saul died. at the hand of the Philistines. And he's sitting around thinking about Jonathan. And you know, he's thinking, I wish he was here. I wish I could just, you know, we had all these plans and he's not around and I just miss my friend. Is there any, what can I do? I can't have him help me. He's not here. It's not the same without him. Well, is there anybody from his family left? You know, because he made an agreement. And again, as we go down through this, there's the literal historical, this is what David did with Mephibosheth. And then there is the spiritual application. And as you go through this, David does some things that we're supposed to do as believers, like showing kindness to those who don't deserve it and some other things. But more than anything, we're a picture of Mephibosheth, really, when you go through here. Okay? And the first thing you do when you come into this chapter is you see David initiating. And David initiates, just like Jesus Christ initiates. God so loved the world. It doesn't say, you know, man so did this that God decided to do. It doesn't say that. God is always the initiator. Man is always the responder. Like when you look at the painting on the top of the Sistine Chapel, Michelangelo got it right. You've got man sitting back, kind of fat and pudgy, mostly naked, with his hand lazily draped out. And then you've got God reaching for all he's worth to reach out to him. And that's the way it is. The Lord always initiates. The Lord is always doing the work. And here he is, looking to show love because of a covenant that was made. And everything that happens to Mephibosheth is a result of the covenant that was made really before he was ever born, an agreement between David and his father. And so David says, is there anybody? And there was of the house of Saul a servant whose name was Ziba. And when they called him unto David, the king said unto him, art thou Ziba? And he said, thy servant he is. And the king said, is there not any of the house of Saul that I may show the kindness of God unto him? See, Ziba was overseeing Saul's stuff. And what would happen when there was a change in the royal family, you know, someone new comes to the throne, the first thing that person would do would go out and wipe out all of the remaining family members from the old regime so that nobody would come up and want to take the throne back, have a claim to the throne. So normally what would happen is they would just wipe out all of the families of who was left. Now, Mephibosheth, we heard about him back in chapter 4, if you remember, and it tells us what happened to him. In 2 Samuel chapter 4, verse 4, it says, and Jonathan, Saul's son, had a son that was lame of his feet. He was 5 years old when the tidings came of Saul and Jonathan out of Jezreel. And his nurse took him up and fled because she was worried, because normally what would happen is they would wipe them all out. She hears Saul is dead, Jonathan is dead. She knows, first of all, in the area that they're at is close to where the battle was, so she wasn't safe there. But second of all, she knew that if David's going to take the throne, and that was what most people thought, Saul was trying to kill him, so we got to get out of here or this kid's dead. So the nurse grabs him, it says, took him up and fled. And it came to pass, as she made haste to flee, that he fell and became lame, and his name was Mephibosheth. She grabs the kid, 5 years old, and starts to run with him and drops him. And it shatters the bones in his feet. You know, and think about this. She's running for her life, drops the child, and this kid, you think about his day, okay? He's a little kid. Daddy's a prince, Grampy's a king. Daddy's a warrior. I'm going to grow up to be a warrior just like Daddy. Grandpa's a king. You know, one day I might be king. He's got all of these ideas. He's got all of these thoughts. He's got all of these plans. He's loving life. And then in one afternoon, he hears, Daddy's dead. Grandpa's dead. And the nurse grabs him and says, we got to run because when David gets here, he's going to kill him. And then he gets dropped, and his legs get busted. And it's not like they immediately give him the morphine and take him to the orthopedic surgeon to get all that stuff set. She picks him up, and she runs with him with shattered legs. And that poor kid is screaming his head off. And that day is the worst day of his entire life when everything changed. Since then, he's nowhere to be found, because if he shows his face, he figures he's dead. That's why, and understand, David is married to Saul's daughter, Michal. Now, they've had some relationship issues. We've gone over that. But it seems even she's not aware of this kid or where he is. He's hiding out. He's in hiding. We find out that he's at somebody else's place. He doesn't even have a place of his own. This guy Ziba is the servant who apparently was overseeing Saul's property and continued to do that. But as far as Mephibosheth knew, he was enemy number one, and if he ever showed his face, he was dead meat. He's got busted feet, so he's lame. And as far as he knows, it's David's fault. Because all he heard was, Daddy's dead, Grampy's dead, David's going to come kill me, I got to run. And in the process of running, I got busted up, so now I can't even walk. I mean, that's his life. He's been in hiding his whole life. He's lame, he's insufficient, and he's in hiding. And so David finds his servant, and he says, isn't there anybody? And David tells the servant, I want to show him kindness. You know, Ziba obviously knew, but it hadn't brought it out where he was. And Ziba said, well, Jonathan hath yet a son, which is lame on his feet. And again, it's important to note that he is lame from a fall. His walk is shattered because of a fall. He's lame from something that happened, you know, a lot of it happened before he was even born. The kindness that was shown to him was an arrangement that was made before he was born. The fall resulted really ultimately from something that happened. It was because of what the enmity that was there between Saul and David. But as far as he knows, David is the one who wants to kill him. In his mind, David is the problem. David is the reason. And so he's hiding out, lame in his feet. And the king said unto him, where is he? And Ziba said unto the king, behold, he's in the house of Maker, the son of Ammiel, in Lodabar. Ammiel means people of God. He's among the people of God. He's in the house of Maker. Maker means sold. In Lodabar means not a pastor. So you think about this guy. He is maybe among the people of God, but he's not in his own house. He's sold. He's in the house of sold. And, you know, to my mind, Romans jumps out. Romans 7:14, for we know that the law is spiritual, but I am carnal, sold under sin. He's in Lodabar, which is not a pasture. He's not in happy ground. He's in a dry place. He's in an unfriendly place. He's not in a place that is, you know, we follow a good shepherd who brings us to green pastures. He's not in that place. He's in a dark place. And notice again, the king David sent and fetched him out of the house of Machir, the son of Ammiel, from Lodabar. David is the one who's initiating. He goes to get him. Now, when the guard shows up, David called for you, come with us. He's got to be freaking out. He's got to think, I'm done for. You know, I don't know how much he knows, but he has no way of escape at this point. He's lame. Where's he going to go? There's nobody to carry him. He's got, I'm sure in some ways, still blaming David for his injuries. Because you can see how he reacts when he gets there in verse 6. Now when Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, was come unto David, he fell on his face and did reverence. And David said, Mephibosheth. And he answered, behold, thy servant. And David said unto him, fear not. The person you say fear not to is the person who's afraid. That's if they're not afraid, there's no reason to say have no fear, because they'd say, I wasn't afraid. You know, my Mephibosheth is freaked out. He's expecting the worst. He's expecting, now that he is in the presence of the king, he's a goner. And really, it's funny, because David never was the enemy of Saul. Saul was the enemy of David. David never wanted to kill Saul. He refused to, time after time after time, but he always said, no, that's the Lord's anointed. I am not. And he loved Jonathan, But yet here's a little boy, and what he knows about David, he's most likely learned from his nurse. Because, you know, when you're rich and powerful and famous and you're a soldier and all of that, you don't raise your own kids, you bring in the nursemaid. And so what he knows about a nurse who thought that she had to flee from David because David wanted to kill him. And he's got this completely wrong impression of who David is at all. And how many people, when you look at the spiritual application, think that God is out to crush them like a bug? You know, they're just waiting for that moment to get struck down. And God is the one who's responsible for all that's wrong in the world because he created evil in the first place. And he's the one who made me this way. And he hates me. God hates me. Well, and then to stand before that God and think, that's it, I'm a goner, I'm done for. And to hear him call you by name. And to hear, fear not. It reminds me of John. And John knew Jesus, but yet when he sees him for who he is, really in his glory in the beginning of Revelation, he fell on his face as though he was dead. And then he hears the fear not, and he feels the hand on his shoulder. And here is Mephibosheth, terrified, only to hear, fear not. For I will surely show thee kindness for Jonathan thy father's sake, and will restore thee all the land of Saul thy father. Not only am I not going to kill you, I'm going to show you kindness. I'm going to give you an inheritance. I'm going to give you all of the land that was your dad's. I'm going to restore your inheritance. In fact, he's going to get more than what his father had. And then he says an unbelievable thing, which is, thou shalt eat bread at my table continually. And that is the thrust of this. You're going to see him say that four times throughout these next few verses. You're going to eat at my table continually. You're going to eat at my table continually. He's going to say in verse 11 that you're going to eat at the table as one of the king's sons. And you think about that, how in one instant he went from being terrified and thinking that the king hated him to hearing his name called and realizing that he had the wrong impression of the king all along. In fact, he was running away and he was hiding from the one who really loved him so much that he wanted to give him an inheritance and he wanted to restore him and he wanted to do even more than that. And you think about us, the promises we have. Peter telling us that we've been begotten unto a lively hope and we have an inheritance that's incorruptible, undefiled, awaiting for us in heaven. And he responded the same way we respond. I know that's how I responded when I started to understand who God was and what he had done and how I was when he had done it. He bowed himself and he said, what is thy servant that thou should look upon such a dead dog as I am? Is there anything more useless than a dead dog? I mean, is there anything that has less value? I mean, a dog in of itself doesn't have much value. I'm a cat kind of guy. I don't really go in for the dogs because they're stupid and they're not much use, but they can bark. I mean, that's, you know, maybe guard your house. A dead one can't even do that. He just lays there and he draws flies. There's nothing else for a dead dog. It's the most worthless, just about the most worthless thing you could think of. And here is Mephibosheth saying, I don't understand. I am completely worthless to you. And look, Mephibosheth, it's not like he's got all this stuff to offer. Well, you're right, King, because I really am a great man, and I'll be a great soldier in your army. He's got busted up feet. He can't even walk. He's lame on his feet. They keep telling us over and over again. He has nothing to bring to the table. He's completely worthless in everyone's eyes. And yet, because of his relationship to his dad, he's worth everything to David. And David responds, verse 9, the king called Ziba, Saul's servant, and said unto him, I have given unto thy master's son all that pertained to Saul and to all his house. Thou therefore and thy sons and thy servants shall till the land for him, and thou shalt bring in the fruit, that thy master's son may have food to eat. Not only am I going to restore everything to him, I want you and your family. You're going to serve him. He gives him servants. He gives him sustenance. But Mephibosheth, thy master's son, shall eat bread always at my table. Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. And you think about this, how God's hand was in all of this. When Mephibosheth is thinking, my life is over, I can't even go back and show my face and get the stuff that used to be mine, the property, I've lost everything, and yet here's a guy named Ziba who God has blessed with a lot of sons and a lot of servants so that Mephibosheth will be provided for. And he would have this land and he would have somebody to work it. And the gifts of God, giving everything that he needs to be able to have the inheritance that was provided for him. Then said Ziba unto the king, according to all that my lord the king has commanded his servant, so shall thy servant do. As for Mephibosheth, said the king, he shall eat at my table as one of the king's sons. As one of the king's sons. Now, I don't know what your house is like. I can tell you what mine was like growing up. You know, one of the constant things that was in my house growing up was we ate together as a family just about every night. We ate, you know, I have two sisters, another father. We ate at the table. My family now, four kids, we eat together frequently. I mean, sometimes everything's crazy and you eat on the run. But by and large, we try to have a family supper where we sit down together. There is stuff that happens at the dinner table that is the best stuff in the world. The best stuff happens at the family dinner table. The things that go on between the kids, you know, and it's funny, I remember even getting up as a kid and going to the table, the breakfast table. I'm still not an early morning person. I like to get up in the morning. My sister, same boat. And so we'd get to the dinner, you know, the breakfast table, and grab the cereal, and it doesn't matter, even, you know, you're going to have some cereal, there's one box, but we always had, you know, 10 boxes of cereal, and you get several boxes out because you have to have the one you're going to eat, but then you got to make a wall. You know, you got to wall yourself in because you don't want any interaction. And just, no, I'm looking at that. Well, you know, and then there's fights over the cereal boxes, and your parents are like, put away the boxes, and, you know, or then you get around the table, and it's time to pray, and it's the same things that I did with my family goes around my dinner table. You know, my sister and I would be the kid when, okay, we're going to pray at the dinner table, hold hands. Well, I would always be the one who would hold hands and then wouldn't let go. You know, want to hold on extra to make you feel uncomfortable and weird, like, let me go. And then my sister would be the one who would want to, I'm not touching him, and grab the wrist, you know, and hold it. Well, now what do I have around my table? I have a son who grabs hands and won't let go, and I have a daughter who likes to just grab wrists. I'm not touching him. The same stuff goes on, but the interaction and the fun that you have around the dinner table. You know, I sit down at night and, you know, we sit down to eat, and then the jokes that happen, the tell daddy about what you learned today. What did you learn in school today? You know, when you start talking to them and the kids tell you the things that they remember and they're joking and they're laughing and they're having, that's like the best time. The best time. The coolest time is when, even now, when we get together and, you know, I have four kids, both my sisters have four kids, and to get everybody together around the dinner table and laughing and joking and remembering those, that's the most awesome time. And you think about that, David says, I want Mephibosheth to be at my table as one of my sons. Because David's table, and he's the king, and when you have a king, you know, they would have big feasts, and there would be, you know, huge number of people there, and you'd have Joab, the head of the army, and Benaiah would be there, and the priests would be there, and the scribes, and all, you know, all those guys would be there, and there'd be big entourages. But yet, there would be, that's not every single night, and sometimes there would just be Solomon there, and there would be Amnon there, and there would be Absalom there, and there would be Tamar there, and there would be David's family, and he says to the child of somebody who was his enemy, I want you to be that kind of family with me. I want you involved. I want you there. I want you to come up to the table and just be part of the family. And it's inconceivable that David would shower that kind of love on him, but then again, when you think about it, it's inconceivable that God would do that for us. And yet, 1 John chapter 3, verse 1, the first half of that verse is, behold, what manner of love the Father has bestowed upon us, that we should be called the sons of God. And to think about God wanting us in that same state. And Mephibosheth had a young son, whose name was Micah. And all that dwelt in the house of Ziba were servants unto Mephibosheth. So Mephibosheth dwelt in Jerusalem, for he did eat continually at the king's table. and was lame on both his feet. He's still lame. And you know the first time he shows up to eat at the king's table, he's feeling stupid. He's feeling out of place. Not only that, everybody's coming in. And, you know, it's sitting around the dinner table is pretty much like coming to church. Everybody has their place. You know, that's my seat. And when you show up and somebody's in the wrong place, so he shows up and he doesn't know where to go. And not only that, if he's even able to walk, he's... I mean, he's lame. He's crippled. He comes in. He's unwieldy. And yet, none of that is an issue because he's family. He's part of the family. He's brought right in there. And it doesn't matter that he has lame feet. You know, when you have little kids and you bring them to the table, that's like kind of the goal because you're used to feeding them somewhere else. And the goal is to get them to the place where they come up to the table. And when they get up there, usually they're out of place. They mess with the whole flow of things. They throw food around. They do all the things that little kids do. But yet you want them there as part of the family, and it's part of growing them and pulling them in. Mephibosheth coming up to the table, it doesn't matter that he has lame feet because you know what? When you sit down at the table, you don't see anybody's feet. Just everybody's part of the family. And those at the king's table, those feet are just completely hidden under the table. And here Mephibosheth is brought up to the table. Now you look at David and the things that he did in here, and he did what Jesus said to do. He loves his enemies, you know, love those who persecute you. And Matthew 25, Jesus said, you know, whenever you minister to those who are poor, hungry, thirsty, sick, whatever, then you've done it unto me. And David takes somebody who is completely unworthy and does the same for him. And he shows the love of God. Mephibosheth, I mean, you look at the parallels between Mephibosheth and us. He's hiding, he's poor, he's weak, he's lame, he's fearful, he's separated. It's happened from ancestors back. He's also separated by his own effort because he's been trying to keep quiet. He thinks God's mad at him. He's sought by the king. He was sought for somebody else's sake. It wasn't for our sake. It was for another's sake. It was a covenant-based thing that he got. In the same way Jesus said, you know, this is a new covenant, a new testament in my blood. Same word. He's restored what was lost. He's given provision at the table. And he's treated as a son with access. And you think about what God wants to do and what he's in the business of doing. Luke chapter 14, Jesus, he's invited to a Pharisee's house. And he's pretty angry with the Pharisee, actually, for the way that he's acting. And he tells a story. And he says this in Luke 14:16. Then said he unto him, a certain man made a great supper and bade many. And he sent his servant at supper time to say to them that were bidden, come, for all things are ready. And they all, with one consent, began to make excuse. And the first said, I bought a piece of ground, and I have to go and see it. Stupid excuse. You bought a piece of ground, and you never even looked at it, and now you've got to go at dinner time to see it? Sure. I pray, therefore, have me excused. Another said, I bought 5 yoke of oxen, and I go to prove them. I just bought a new tractor, but I haven't tried it. I need to go, you know, I got my oxen, I got to... Another said, I have married a wife, and therefore I cannot come. Lame excuse. Lame excuse. I've married a wife, and so I can't bring her to dinner. You know, you look at the attitude of the guy who's calling the dinner, and you realize she would be welcome. So the servant came and showed his lord these things. And the master of the house, being angry, said to his servant, go out quickly into the streets and the lanes of the city, and bring hither the poor, and the maimed, and the halt, and the blind. And the servant said, Lord, it's done as thou hast commanded, and yet there is room. And the Lord said unto the servant, go out into the highways and the hedges, and compel them to come in, that my house may be filled. And you think about the Lord so wanting people at his table to be like his sons and daughters, that he takes the lame and the blind. I mean, that's us. We're the lame, we are the blind, we are the halt, we are the maimed. And we are lame on both his feet. And I think it's going to be interesting to note when we get to heaven that everybody sitting at that table, except for God, is going to be lame in the feet. All around the table, all of those people, even the Hebrews 11 crowd, the Hall of Faith, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, all of the prophets, if you were to duck under the table, you'd see lame feet all the way around. But God, I guess he's in the business of inviting lame people to his table. You ready, Bobby? Let's do a song. I'll pray. Lord, thank you so much that you are, Lord, willing to have people like us at your table. Lord, that we're all welcome. Lord, I pray that you would give us your heart, that we would seek out those who are lame and who are under the misconception that you're mad at them and that you are the cause of all their problems, when truthfully you are the answer to all of their problems. Lord, help us bring in everyone we can to enjoy the blessings that you've laid on us. Let's get in Jesus' name.